I'm Susan Yawkey with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, Syria's opposition accuses Hezbollah of widening the war. An appeal for reform in the Iraqi justice system.
Actually investigating, and it's obvious that somebody is coming into their courthouse having been tortured.
A $10 billion weapons package to counter Iran threats. And French Jews search for a new leader. It's all ahead. Syria's opposition is accusing the Lebanese Hezbollah movement of declaring war on the Syrian people, amid reports that the Shiite militia's fighters are joining Syrian government forces in a battle against rebels in the central province of Homs. VOA's Mark Snowis reports from Washington.
Anti-government activists in the Syrian town of Al-Qusair outside Homs have reported mounting Hezbollah casualties in the last week as fighting heats up in the strategic pocket along the Lebanese border. The opposition's Syrian Revolution General Commission said Free Syrian Army forces killed 18 Hezbollah fighters in clashes earlier this week. An activist who uses the pseudonym Abu Imad told VOA that FSA fighters retook two villages in the fighting, capturing 10 Hezbollah militiamen and killing a commander.
We have prisoners of them. We have some IDs today because of the clashes and the battle going on. We have 10 prisoners, and a lot of them got killed, actually.
The extent of Hezbollah's engagement in Syria cannot be independently verified. Long an ally of Syria's President Bashar al-Assad, Hezbollah has denied involvement in the Syrian fighting, saying it is helping Lebanese Shiites living in border towns and villages to defend themselves against rebel assaults. But Washington Institute analyst Matthew Levitt says the group's recruitment efforts have increased the flow of Lebanese Shiite fighters crossing the border.
Some of the people more recently who are going to fight are Hezbollah militias that they've created, popular committees they call them.
Levitt puts at 200 the number of known Lebanese Shiites killed in Syria over the last 2 years. An estimate, he says, comes by account of reported martyrs' funerals with, quote, a clear connection to Hezbollah. Paul Salem, director of the Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut, says the Assad government some time ago effectively handed over defensive security responsibilities for a number of Shiite villages north of Damascus to Hezbollah. But, he says, the militia's involvement in offensive operations has escalated mostly in the last 10 days.
What's new is the fighting in a slightly different area, which is in the area of Qusair, which is further north, in the area between the city of Homs and the region further west. That is an area which is not an area of Shiite villages, not an area where Hezbollah previously sort of had social and political presence.
Hezbollah, a major political and military force, was helped by the Syrian government when it occupied Lebanon during the Lebanese Civil War. Syria, too, has been a conduit for helping Hezbollah maintain its strong relationship with Iran. Most of Hezbollah's arsenal that has been used in strikes against Israel is smuggled into Lebanon from Syria.
They are part of a broader Iranian alliance system. They don't want that alliance system to break in Damascus. The Iranians are helping. Hezbollah is helping.
By maintaining a secure corridor, analysts say, Hezbollah would ensure continued access to the sea through Syrian ports and allow the Iranian weapons flow to continue. Liberating Sunni-held territory is also crucial to preparing a possible retreat for Syrian government leaders to coastal provinces that are a stronghold of Mr. Assad's minority Alawite sect, an offshoot of Shiite Islam. The Syrian opposition's new interim leader, George Sabra, said in Istanbul this week that the Lebanese president and the Lebanese government should realize the danger that Hezbollah poses to the lives of Syrians and regional relations. Mark Snowis, VOA News, Washington.
A landmark minaret of a 12th century mosque in the northern Syrian city of Aleppo now lays in ruins. The Syrian government and opponents exchange blame for what led to the destruction to the Umayyad Mosque, a UNESCO World Heritage Site inside Aleppo's old walled city. Syria's state news agency blamed fights from the al-Qaeda-linked al-Nusra Front for blowing it up. An Aleppo-based activist group said a Syrian army tank fired a shell on the minaret, destroying it. Ghassan Hito, the interim Syrian opposition prime minister, was asked to comment on the mosque's destruction.
This regime has been destroying schools and has been destroying mosques, has been destroying homes. 70% of the schools in Syria have been destroyed. Over 870,000 homes have been destroyed, and let alone thousands of mosques, minarets have been destroyed. And this is just another example of the criminal acts of the Assad regime.
Gassen Hito, the interim Syrian opposition prime minister, speaking in Turkey. The mosque has been under rebel control for months as battles continued in Aleppo's historic corridor. Syrian government troops in recent days have attempted to regain control of the area. A striking increase in executions in Iraq points out the failure of Iraq's justice system to meet international fair trial standards, Human Rights Watch says. We spoke about the findings with HRW Middle East researcher Aaron Evers in Baghdad.
The problems kind of permeate every part of the system, so beginning with kind of arrests and continuing through the trial process. We have documented numerous instances of illegal arrests, which means, you know, without warrants, mass arrests of people who seem to be targeted for the area in which they live, and not, you know, arrests that are not based on evidence or not for specific individuals. Then, you know, we documented ubiquitous, basically, use of torture during interrogations. And then trials in which people are convicted based on coerced confessions or on secret informant testimony rather than on evidence.
And do you believe that the Iraq government is using executions as an easy way to deal with the criminal problems?
I don't know that I can kind of try to guess like why they're using executions the way they are. I don't know that I would characterize it as an easy way to deal with the problems, but it does seem suspicious that, you know, rather than kind of going through the process of implementing these reforms that they've been undertaking for the last 4 months, they're suddenly executing people in waves. I think that especially as violence increases, as people feel more unstable, and around election time, I think that the timing is really suspicious.
What sort of reforms would you like to see?
Well, we'd like to see basically reforms that would enable the transition of Iraq's criminal justice system from a confession-based system to an evidence-based system, which would mean reforming security forces in the interior and defense ministries and bringing security forces that are directly answerable to the prime minister under the auspices of a ministry, so that there's a proper kind of a chain of command in which there's accountability for officers that commit abuses and in which it's not encouraged that high-ranking officers order the commission of abuses. We would like to see basically security forces comporting with their obligations under the Criminal Procedure Code, which would require them to only arrest people on the basis of an arrest warrant or when confronted with a weapon, require them to bring people to investigative judges within 24 hours, and then we basically just want to see a judiciary that actually works, because, you know, all of these problems would not be able to proliferate the way they were if there was a judiciary that was actively doing its job and refusing to convict people on the basis of completely specious evidence and actually investigating when it's obvious that somebody is coming into their courthouse having been tortured.
Human Rights Watch Middle East researcher Aaron Evers speaking with us from Baghdad. U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel, on his trip to the Middle East, has delivered a $10 billion weapons package to Israel and some of Washington's Arab allies as a sign of U.S. support in the face of Iranian threats. VOA Pentagon correspondent Luis Ramirez has details.
Secretary Hagel's visit to Israel could have been awkward. He was accused of being anti-Israel during his nomination hearing, but he got a warm welcome, as did the weapons package he took with him.
The United States will make available to Israel a set of advanced new military capabilities, which he has noted, including anti-radiation missiles and advanced radars for its fleet of fighter jets, KC-135 refueling aircraft, and most significantly, the V-22 Osprey, which the U.S. has not released to any other nation.
The offerings are a clear sign to Iran, which poses the biggest threat to Israel and the values it shares with the U.S., as Hagel was reminded by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Nowhere are these values and interests challenged more than by the arming of terrorist groups by Iran with sophisticated weapons, and equally Iran's attempt to arm itself with nuclear weapons.
A big challenge for Israel is the distance its jets would have to travel to hit Iranian nuclear targets if it chose to do that. The new refueling aircraft will help close the gap, says defense analyst Tim Brown.
The refueling tankers give the Israelis the ability to do the strike regardless of the range of any specific aircraft.
But Washington continues to oppose a unilateral Israeli strike. Not included in this package are the U.S. earth-penetrating bombs that Israel could use to attack Iranian underground facilities. And analyst Anthony Cordesman says Israel does not have the larger aircraft required to deliver those weapons.
I don't think anyone, when they pause, is going to say that the United States should be transferring stealth bombers to anyone, even its closest allies, particularly when those bombers cost the United States over $1 billion. A plane.
Hagel's stops in the region included visits and weapons offers to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, a sign the U.S. also wants to help its Arab partners counter any future threats from Iran. Luis Ramirez, VOA News at the Pentagon.
The search is on for a new chief rabbi to lead Europe's largest Jewish community. Lisa Bryan in Paris has more on the story and on the issues dividing France's 600,000-member Jewish community.
Donc à Metz, il y avait une communauté juive importante, ils avaient le droit d'être. C'était une ville de garnison et les juifs fournissaient beaucoup de choses.
At his Paris apartment, Rabbi Yeshaya Dalzas shows a visitor mementos from his ancestors, Jews from Eastern France. Dalzas comes from a long line of Ashkenazi Jews from Eastern Europe who traditionally led French Judaism. France's top rabbi, Gilles Bernheim, shares those same ethnic origins. But that's where the similarities end. Dalzas belongs to the more centrist conservative branch of Judaism. Bernheim is an Orthodox Jew, the branch that now dominates French synagogues and leadership structure. That structure was shaken earlier this month when Bernheim took leave from his post as Grand Rabbi of France after admitting to plagiarizing certain texts and not being truthful about his academic credentials.
Bernheim, c'est quelqu'un qui a, sur lequel les quantités de gens avaient mis beaucoup d'espoir.
Dalza says Bernheim's departure has disappointed many practicing Jews. They had high hopes that Bernheim would change many things, including the Central Consistory, the chief religious authority that gathers hundreds of synagogues in France and its overseas territories. Critics say the Consistory is slow to reform and to respond to practical issues facing Jews today, like mixed marriages. A bookish intellectual, Bernheim is viewed as embracing a more modern strain of Orthodox Judaism. He's spoken out often against anti-Semitism in France and has been a leader in interfaith dialogue. Martin Cohen is a specialist on Judaism at the Group on Society, Religion and Secularity, a Paris-based research organization.
La personne de Bernheim, malgré sa ligne orthodoxe,
Cohen says that despite his strong orthodoxy, Bernheim attracted a certain consensus among intellectuals and even among some non-practicing and non-believing Jews because he advocated the need to be open to current issues facing society. Judaism in France has changed dramatically over the last few decades. During the 1950s and 60s, tens of thousands of Sephardic Jews from North Africa immigrated here. They were more traditional than many of France's Ashkenazi Jews. France's previous Grand Rabbi, Tunisian-born Joseph Sitruk, personified this change. But in 2008, Bernheim took over the top post from Sitruk after a hard-fought campaign.
Dans cette campagne précédente, il y a eu déjà
Analyst Cohen says that campaign underscored the two currents of Orthodox Judaism in France. The one embraced by Bernheim, she says, is open to interreligious dialogue, social issues, and women's place in the religion. The other, an ultra-Orthodox current embraced by Sitruk, is more inward-looking. Cohen believes these competing visions will again come to the fore as French Jews search for a new top rabbi. One of Bernheim's supporters is Natalie Cohen-Bizerman, who holds senior posts in several Jewish organizations.
C'est un rabbin qui a vraiment fait des choses énormes pour la communauté. Je me place en tant que femme juive.
Cohen-Bizerman says Bernheim has done enormous things for the Jewish community. He's advanced the status of Jewish women in terms of religious divorce and other matters. He's also helped organize a women's studies center and supported a campaign to fight violence against women within the community. Ultra-Orthodox Lubavitch Rabbi Mendel Asimov praises both Bernheim and his predecessor, Sitruk.
Both were great. Both had advances. One was closer to the nation, and one was a little further, but gave very strong statement.
Asimov says he would be happy if either type of personality became the next grand rabbi.
Le judaïsme est toujours resté neutre sur ces questions, n'a pas pris position. Même si quelquefois il peut avoir...
But Dalzas is disappointed in Bernheim. He opposes the Grand Rabbi's strong and public opposition to the French government's plans to legalize gay marriage. He believes the Jewish leadership should not take a stand on political issues.
Là-dessus, le grand rabbin Gilles Bernheim a été justement quelqu'un d'ouvert.
Dalzas says Bernheim's views are all the more surprising since the Grand Rabbi initially reached out to gays within the Jewish community. Dalzas believes this kind of reaching out is necessary if France is to build a more open and inclusive brand of Judaism. But he does not think this will happen. The Central Consistory says elections for the next Grand Rabbi will not be held for at least 6 months. It's also unclear whether Bernheim can or will return to his post, as some Jews here, hope will happen. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.